will come to order. Time is 3:35. Today we have, first time I've heard this term for Agrium, Agrium Canine Nitrogen Operations. And our intent is essentially to look at a technique, but whatever technique, blue sky wise, that works to make Agrium successful. And we have numerous players with us, but Tim, I'll let you do the introduction of the players. But first, I'd like to welcome Matt Sue Burrow, Mayor and Manager. Good to have you with us.
Okay, very good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tim, excuse me, I'm mentally bankrupt today. We have Senator Green, Senator Stevens, Wagner, Wilikowski, Bert Stedman, and Charlie Huggins. Please continue.
Okay, great. Thank you. And for us, my name is Tim Johnson. I'm the project manager for Agrium's Kenai Blue Sky Gasification Project. We have Dan Graham from Yusubeli Coal Mine. We have Bill O'Leary from the Alaska Railroad. And Mr. Pat Gamble, the CEO of the Alaska Railroad, are here today.
Okay. And I think, Bill Pop, are you there?
He's not online.
Not online. Okay. Okay. And, excuse me, Donna Bolts. Hi, Donna. Hey, Donna, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Okay, very good. Welcome, and we're pleased to have you online with us today, and we will revisit with you here in a bit.
Excellent. Thank you for letting us phone in.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead, Tim.
Okay. Well, thank you again for the chance to be here and the chance to talk about our gasification project. Our goal today was to explain about our operation in Kenai, and what our facility does and the situation that brought us to look into coal gasification. Our plant in Kenai, if you're not familiar with it, is a fertilizer production facility. We've been in business since 1968. The plant was expanded in 1977. And so for almost 40 years, we've been on the Kenai Peninsula as the second largest nitrogen fertilizer production facility in North America, producing ammonia and urea fertilizer that is exported around the Pacific Rim, the United States, and around the world. And that plant has been running successfully for many years. And it was built on stranded gas. The large amounts of stranded gas that were available in the Kenai Peninsula in the late 60s and early 70s is what brought that plant to the reality. And today, we're facing a very different situation of gas supply in the Cook Inlet. The gas supply in Cook Inlet today, from an industrial user standpoint, is at a crisis situation. We've got a declining supply of these large reserves that built these large industrial bases in the early 60s and 70s. The pricing structure that's now in place, where it's tied to a NYMEX-type pricing, and the overall supply of gas is forcing industry out of business. We've got increasing demand for our consumer and residential users, both from an electrical and from a heat standpoint. There's a large amount of export of liquefied natural gas to Japan. And these large reserves are not being replenished. In 2000, Agrium purchased the production facilities from Unocal Corporation. We purchased those facilities believing that there was a long-term gas supply in place. Soon after the purchase of the fertilizer facilities, the gas supplies began to decline. We were in discussions with Unocal and eventually settled the gas supply situation. And that settlement resulted in our supplies under that Unocal contract being depleted in 2005. I'd also like to thank the state of Alaska for the support that they have given Agrium as we have worked to develop and continue our operations. We've had tremendous support, and that has been very important, including House Bill 57 and the support that you have provided for this Kenai Blue Sky project. If you look at the traditional supply of gas, from starting here in 2001, you can see what was the standard picture for Alaska's Kenai nitrogen operations, consuming about 53 billion cubic feet of gas year in and year out, producing over 1.2 million tons of fertilizer for export. When the gas supply decline started hitting in 2001, 2002, our business started to suffer. In 2004, we made the announcement that we would only have gas through 2005. We shut down our first urea production facility. in October of 2004. In October of 2005, we shut down another ammonia plant. We've lost a total of 80 jobs since that time. In 2006, we are operating with only two plants in production. Those plants have been shut down, and we have suspended manufacturing since the 23rd of October of 2006. And we hope to start up hopefully by the end of the first quarter of 2007. We have gas now to continue operations through the end of 2007 and no other gas contracts into the future. We continue to pursue that, and that's a key part of our long-term operations and long-term plans to develop a supply for our production facility. And it's also the reason that we've looked for another alternative. The plant is built on having a long-term supply of low-cost feedstock, and that's what we hope to obtain through gasification. So the major driver for our gasification project is this severe decline in Cook Inlet supplies. We have a very large facility there whose replacement value is significant. And without a gas supply past October 31st of 2007, the facility will no longer be able to continue to operate. The impact of jobs as a total, we've already lost 80. Over 400 direct and indirect jobs would be impacted with a complete shutdown of the facility. We'd lose a substantial tax base to the Kenai Peninsula Borough. And we lose Agrium, which currently stands as Alaska's third largest exporter.
Tim, what is the export volume in dollars?
I'll ask Lisa Parker. Do you have that figure? $163 million last year. And so what this project seeks to do is it seeks to capitalize on this long-term supply of abundant coal that's available in Alaska. We've got our second largest nitrogen manufacturing complex in North America to anchor this. We've got a demand for low-cost power in South Central Alaska. Additionally, there are 13 oil fields that are declining and nearing the end of their useful life in the Cook Inlet region. Studies by Department of Energy indicate that up to 300 million barrels of additional oil could be recovered by supplying CO2 for enhanced oil recovery, which is made available through this project. And there are additional market opportunities for byproducts from the gasification process. This is an overview picture of our facility. In the foreground is the Agrium's Kenai Nitrogen operations. You can also see north of that ConocoPhillips liquid natural gas production facility. The Tesoro refinery and the open field to the south is where we would site the new gasification and power production complex.
Yep. Could you do us a favor and point to those so that everyone's aware of where they are?
Yes. Let me see if this pointer will come up and work here. If not, I'll grab a laser. I'm sorry, I'm not finding my pointer handy.
Okay. Use your manual pointer, your right index.
That's right. Let's see if I can just walk up there. This is the Agrium Kenai Nitrogen Operations facility here. The north is the ConocoPhillips liquefied natural gas and the Tesoro refinery up here. And this is the area where we'll look to site the gasifier and the power production complex. The map shows the location overall for the project. The project is looking to bring coal from Healy or other coal sources within Alaska. The coal would be transported via rail down to the Anchorage area and shipped from a port in the Anchorage area by barge down to our existing facility in Nikiski. We'd construct a new dock to receive the coal in that area, and that would be supplied to both the gasifier and the power production facility. And then CO2 would be shipped to the existing oil fields in the area, excess power would be sold to the grid, and our fertilizer production would be continued to export from that facility, as well as supplying all of the Alaska demand for fertilizer. So the value proposition for the project is built on the Kenai Nitrogen Operations, or Kenai Nitrogen Facility. The new gasifier would convert coal and air into the building blocks that are needed for fertilizer production. The gasifier supplies hydrogen and nitrogen and CO2 to our current fertilizer facility. And a large amount of excess power is needed and required. We would build a large power plant, supply at least 100 megawatts of power to the process, and additional power through our partnership with Homer Electric would be made available to the power grid. We'd also make excess CO2 available for sale to the oil fields for enhanced oil recovery. Now this graph is a more detailed view of the same process. In a very simple overview, the gasification process works by bringing in a coal or any carbon source into the gasifier and combining it with pure oxygen. That reaction produces the building blocks we need for fertilizer. We're looking at about 3 million metric tons of coal needed for gasification and for power production. That'll produce almost 1.5 million tons of urea for export and at least 100,000 tons of ammonia for export. Right now we're looking at 70 megawatts of power available to the grid, as well as CO2 available for enhanced oil recovery. The other thing you can see from this picture is that the process is highly integrated. A lot of energy is needed for the gasifier, for the power plant, and for the fertilizer facility. That energy is shared and integrated. That's why these facilities must be located by each other. They can't be relocated remotely, so a gasifier cannot be relocated at a mine site and then ship their products to the fertilizer facility. The coal must be transported and all the facilities must be located where the existing plant is. Our project approach is to take a disciplined investment approach and a disciplined look at investing in the project. We completed a phase one feasibility study. Now we move into a more detailed front-end engineering and design study, where we look at putting together the final engineering design basis and begin the process of permitting the project. When that is complete, we'll look at moving into the detailed engineering and final permitting, and then the final stage of the project will be the construction and startup.
Tim, could you share with us a moment which phase four, a rough time frame, one would be reasonable based on some reasonableness reaching phase three?
Our current project schedule has us completing phase two in the summer of 2008. Phase three is another 12 months beyond that. So we'd begin phase four, the construction period, in about 2009, the summer of 2009. And we'd look to begin startup operations late in 2011, say third quarter 2011. The details around phase one, it was a joint effort with Usabelli Coal Mine. Agrium invested about $3 million total into this effort. We looked at different options for providing power with an IGCC or a PC boiler. We looked at many different sites, feedstocks, and locations. We looked at a wide variety of design cases, trying to maximize our existing ammonia plants, maximize our existing urea plants, trying to take advantage of economies of scale. And we determined that there was a feasible project to move forward into the next phase, and the best design was to try and maximize our urea production. The reason for that is that because of CO2 produced by gasification, we can make more tons of fertilizer per ton of coal by maximizing urea. At the same time, Department of Energy also conducted a gasification study similar to our own investigations, with similar results showing that there was a viable project there and that gasification could be economically conducted with the Kenai Nitrogen operations. Now we're in the phase two feed study. We're in partnership with Homer Electric. Homer Electric has the lead role in the power block development. So they will go out and seek partners to help develop the power production facility. We'll look to finalize the size and export power from the power plant. We will look to finalize our gasification technology and maximize our integration into the existing plant. We're currently doing due diligence on the feedstock supply and availability. We'll prepare to do environmental permitting and begin environmental permitting this phase. We'll work to bring in a partner to be financing the gasification island. And we need to continue to find and secure natural gas resources for the existing plant. Part of the key to our success is the existing facility, existing personnel, maintaining operations and maintaining a presence in Alaska between now and the startup of the project is critical. And so our people are out right now looking for additional gas supplies and looking to obtain additional gas for operations until we can start up this project. It's an overview timeline, again, the same picture of what we've looked at before with more details and the timelines that you were looking at. Summer 2008 is when we would look to complete Phase 2. During Phase 2, there'll be checkpoints for all the investors along the way to make sure throughout Phase 2 it makes sense. The same will happen in Phase 3, that it makes sense to continue investment. And if things continue on the current timeline, we begin construction in the spring of 2009. Spring-summer 2009. So to conclude the overview, that there is, from our Phase 1 feasibility investigations, a viable project in the Kenai. Coal can replace the natural gas feedstock. The project has many benefits to Alaska. And there's not any obstacles in the environmental permitting. We took a very detailed look at environmental permitting of gasification and power plants in the Kenai industrial area. We believe it is possible and very viable to do that. Now we're beginning the engineering work nail the detailed design down, to verify that feedstock is available, to look at these coal and power partnerships. We have a relationship with Homer Electric, and we're continuing to advance our relationships on the feedstock side. We will be screening these gasification partners who will come in and invest in the gasifier block itself, and we'll be selecting the permitting contractor to take forward environmental permits for the project. So that concludes our overview presentation, and we can go through and answer any questions that you would have.
Okay, questions for Tim? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. My understanding is there are limitations on the amount of mercury that can be released by coal plants under the Clean Air Act. My understanding is that Alaska's been allocated about 10 pounds of mercury to be released per year, and is that your understanding? And if so, how do you get around that with this coal gasification plant?
Okay, the plans for mercury, the impact on mercury is actually a new legislation, the Clean Air Mercury Rule, mm-hmm. and that does have an allocation, a minor allocation to the state of Alaska. There is litigation pending to challenge that allocation. In addition to that, there's a provision in the Clean Air Mercury Rule for a trading program that would allow trading of mercury credits. And so projects could trade with other states that have mercury emissions credits. And then finally, we would look to minimize mercury emissions through air quality in the engineering design. And that's part of the work that we're going in right now, is to determine what is the best mercury scrubbing technologies. We knew that the Clean Air Mercury Act was in place, and so that is part of the evaluation when we determined there were no showstoppers for permitting. And in the worst case, it would be a scenario where we do a cap and trade program to provide the mercury credits.
And then, if I could, slightly different question on the transmission lines. Do the transmission lines for you to tie in to ship your excess power, are they sufficient, or do we need new transmission lines?
Transmission lines on the Kenai Peninsula, if I can go back to the map. Transmission on the Kenai is limited. The current grid runs around the Turnagain Arm, and it's limited to about 70 megawatts of export power. And so that's the amount of export power that we would look to have in place right now. New transmission lines would obviously make more transmission available, but that is not something we are considering as part of this project. So our export magnitude is limited by the amount of transmission that's currently available.
So your understanding is that the current transmission lines, you're able to ship, you're able to export about 70 megawatts of power into the South Central energy?
There's about 70 megawatts of export capability off of the Kenai, and working with Homer Electric, we will look to see if that can be commercialized. We are currently doing an engineering study to determine the grid response, but it looks like 70 megawatts can be shipped off the Kenai.
Thank you.
Senator Wagner?
Go a little further, excuse me, go a little further into that as to what size the power plant would be and how much of that power you'll use on site, would you, Tim?
You bet. Yes, Senator. Let's see. We look at this picture. The power plant itself is sized to be about 200 megawatts of electrical power. Roughly 120 megawatts would be used, 120 to 130 megawatts would be used inside the fence to supply the air separation unit, the gasifier, the existing fertilizer plant. Additionally, there's about 85 megawatts worth of thermal energy that's transferred to the fertilizer plant as steam. And so roughly a total of almost 300 megawatts of energy is produced and consumed by the process. 70 megawatts is exported to the grid for power consumption.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
thank you. How much gas currently, or you might not know this figure, but if you do, how much gas is currently produced and put into storage versus made available for your use because of the low or the high demand times during this time of the year?
I'm not familiar with the exact amount. I know that it is correct. There is a lot of gas. There is gas going into storage right now, but I'm not familiar with the numbers.
Okay. And the last question I've got, CO2 is one of your byproducts. Are there other possibilities of other byproducts and things we could be doing with those byproducts and kind of an added value as far as another small industry?
You bet. In addition to the CO2 as a byproduct, the gasifier produces what's known as slag, which is molten ash from the coal. That slag is completely inert, and so it does not represent a waste. And where these gasifiers now exist in the Netherlands, in China, in Spain, that slag is put to use as a value-added byproduct. It can be sold for road base. It can be used in the production of cinder block or construction block. So there's a lot of potential for that material to be used as well as a value-added byproduct.
Thank you.
Yeah, other questions for Tim? Tim, just looking at a couple scenarios. I know we have usability here, but once upon a time we were talking about beluga coal. Mm-hmm. And could you just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of the process you went through and where you see beluga coal playing in this or not playing in it in now and in the future?
Mm-hmm. Early on in our development, we looked exclusively at beluga coal. And as we went through and looked at the capabilities of the Healy mine, we found that there was a scenario where the Healy mine could fit well with about this 3 million tons of production. When we did that, we arrived at the conclusion that Healy was an option for supply. We're currently looking at both options for supply. An advantage for Healy is that it's an existing mine, an existing operation with a rail link that can be established to water. Beluga is a very large resource with many available reserves, with a mine that is in permitting but not in production. And so both are options for feedstock, and both are under consideration. But we have been working on the Healy option to help us develop our preliminary feasibility economics.
Yeah. Would it be reasonable to say that in some future year, I don't know, 2025, that it may be more economical to move coal from Beluga, assuming there's an opening in the logistical train to support it?
Beluga coal offers an advantage in that it is closer, and so that there is less transportation. But it also has to overcome the capital of starting up a new mine, and so there's definitely trade-offs between both. And as a mine is developed, there is a possibility that could become the case. It's certainly difficult to project which would be the most economical at this point, but it does have a location advantage.
Yeah, no, I understand. Let me switch gears quickly onto natural gas. And I may have the wrong impression, but my impression was that supply may be a difficulty for you, but cost may be a greater challenge for you, natural gas. Is that true or false?
In our current situation, our biggest challenge is with supply.
Supply, okay.
There simply hasn't been the supply available. We lost supply early in October before we projected to lose supply in November. And it's not, although there will eventually be a price concern, at this point in time, the supply is our problem.
Right. So let me interpret that for a moment. At present market value in Cook Inlet, if there was supply available, it would work for you?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. If FERC denied the LNG permit, which is up, I think, next year or the year after, what kind of impact would that have on your ability to continue to use natural gas, number one? And number two, how does natural gas, assuming that we were to get a gas pipeline, how do the costs compare between shipping this coal down and say putting a spur line in and using natural gas from the North Slope?
Okay, two questions. One is the question of gas supply and the current application for the continued export of LNG. In that case, we are still in negotiations with all of the producers, and we're looking to try and obtain gas for our plant currently. For the longer term, the supply of natural gas from the North Slope will be something that seems to be out of sync with our project timing. And we want to be up and operating as soon as possible, as early as 2011. And so at that point, if gas is available, I believe the earliest timelines would be in the 2015-2020 time frame. It would at that point be a comparison of which is the most economical. And in trying to bridge that gap, one of our key measures of success right now is obtaining gas to keep the facility up and operating. It becomes much more of a challenge to do that, waiting for a North Slope supply of gas for the facility.
Okay. Other questions for Tim? Any? Yep. Senator Wagner.
Which of the two resources have the, how should I put it, are the least volatile in price ranges?
Between coal and natural gas. Coal is a much more stable price, and so if the capital hurdle can be overcome to install a coal gasification unit, it provides you a much more stable long-term cost of feedstock supply and energy. Natural gas is much more volatile, and any natural gas supply from the North Slope, if it's connected via a pipeline to the lower 48, would be indexed to NYMEX, and that would make it more susceptible to volatility and therefore more difficult to predict a long-term economic viability.
A follow-up question on coal and, quote, clean coal. Could you give us just a quick rundown on the gasification process? And I know we alluded to mercury, but are there other things that we should be aware of or be pleased with about coal?
There's a lot to be pleased with about coal, especially in terms of gasification, because the process of gasification is a very high-energy process. It captures many of those impurities in the slag and at the high temperature. And what's not shown in this simple diagram is all the processing that takes place downstream of the gasifier, where the impurities in coal, such as sulfur, mercury, and those types of emissions are captured. So by processing coal with gasification, you produce a very clean source of feedstock for the fertilizer plant. The coal-fired power plant, we are looking to determine the ultimate source of firing, but right now our power block design is using a coal-fired boiler. And we'd look to use modern techniques and modern air quality capturing designs that would be much better than old-style coal technology. And so with a very low sulfur coal like Alaska coal, you have a very environmentally friendly production facility, both on the gasification and on the power side.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. The report came out recently about mercury in some of Alaska's fish, halibut. Do we have some kind of assurances that the use of this coal will not increase the amount of mercury that we're finding in our fish and in other wildlife?
Our initial evaluations was a detailed environmental screening on the air quality emissions from the project. The air quality emissions will be a very high standard of controls. In addition to the air quality, the bigger concern for fish would be on the water side. And on the water side, from the gasification plant, anywhere coal is touching the process, we'll use a zero liquid discharge process to collect any wastewater and treat it so that there will not be a liquid discharge from the coal gasification process and facilities. And that will greatly eliminate any chance or risk of mercury contamination into water.
Just follow. I don't know the process how it works, but is some of it released into the air and then brought down in the rain, in the form of rain? Is that how it's somehow released?
Eventually, some of that could be possible, and that's why we will look to minimize any air emissions of mercury.
Okay. Other questions for Tim? Tim, thank you very much. Who do you have following yourself here?
We can take open questions, I think, probably from the railroad, because one of the proposals that we have for financing of the project would be to work with the Alaska Railroad and their bonding ability to help provide some of the financing for the project.
Okay. Wait, if you could pass the mic over to Mr. Gamble. And Senator McGuire joined us about 20 minutes ago. She was in another committee meeting. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were approached by AgRAM some time ago on this project from standpoint of two categories. One is the transportation of the product, and the other one is the possibility of a separate but related issue is the possibility of contributing to financing with the use of the railroad's tax-free bonding capability. And I brought Mr. Bill O'Leary, our CFO, that can talk to the details of that should you want to get into that. But as a blanket statement, what we've done is asked AgRAM for a tasking, which they have given us, to sit down and provide them, through a confidentiality agreement, technical information regarding both transmission of transportation of the product with regard to rates and operational capability and so on and so forth. And at the same time, our financing team, and as you may be aware, you know, we issued the first segment of up to $165 million worth of bonds already. So we have a financial team who are in place and set to run the models and analyze a project of this size. And we have likewise engaged them simultaneously to look at the funding side of this. So we are busy in direct response to AgRAM's questions. On the operating side, they've asked us to look at all possible alternatives with regard to the transportation. And so we have options like the Port McKenzie option or the Port of Anchorage option or the Seward option or building a railroad track down to the site option. They went across the board because they wanted to make sure they had covered all possibilities. Of course, a couple of those were pretty quickly eliminated, and we're starting to focus in along with them as they get farther along into the phase. But we're very, very much a part of this discussion with them at the present time.
Okay.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
I just wonder if Mr. Gamble could go into a little more detail on some of the options. The building extending the railroad seemed to me to be like a reasonable one, but that simply is not practical.
Well, I mean, we're not complete with all of the analysis, but I think, for example, the extension to Kenai is not practical. I would certainly agree with that statement right here at the table. We've already got the rail to the Port of Anchorage, and so then it becomes a matter of, as you analyze the port, what are the efficiencies that as the port grows and as we design this into a growing port, how can we design in this offload capability so that we can take advantage of the port and the space that's available and the technology to offload the train quickly and get it headed back the other direction. And we're certainly looking into that with the port. And at the same time, another one is the idea of extending the rail line from somewhere in the neighborhood of Willow. The junction of the main line would peel off a spur that would be about a 42-mile long spur down to the port of McKenzie. And once again, there's fairly blank slate down there to be able to design in an approach, an offload area, a pile for optimum pile management, and the pile management issue is an important one that Usabelli can talk to. And so we're looking at that one, too. That's a significant investment, true, but we're also working with the borough to look at how that investment might be made and what the railroad position on something like that might be. So we actually have a pretty good teaming effort in that department as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's very interesting, and I'm thinking you're going to have such an efficient operation to the Seward facility that, but then you'd have to transport it by ship from Seward around the peninsula. So that's a pretty difficult process, I assume.
Well, it's not so difficult, but I mean it's a time distance issue, and time and distance are related to expense at the same time, and it's very much the kind of calculations we do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions of the railroad? Yeah, if I might, then Pat, one of the things we talked about with some of your representatives in the past was the corridor to Point McKenzie. Obviously, is attractive to some of us based on, you know, the neighborhood where we live and what have you. But from a state's perspective, it appears that assuming some growth potential of the port, that places like Anchorage would probably in the future welcome this, maybe, and we'll hear from Anchorage in a moment. But when you come to gas pipeline sort of things, that there is at least some potential to be able to haul from a port like that versus through, you know, the port of Anchorage, and there are probably a number of other ports. But would that be feasible, assuming some rail hooking to the port, Point McKenzie?
Two parts to the answer to that question, Mr. Chairman. I mean, number one, Port McKenzie, from a transportation point of view and from the railroad's point of view, is a pricey project. But if you can find a way to hurdle that first one, you, in fact, lay down for the state and for the whole region a real opportunity to move goods to Tidewater that would be hard to move all the way around to the port of Anchorage. For example, if you're they're working wood chips right now, they've got a lot of potential to do a lot more than wood chips. There's a lot of resource products in the interior that would probably do well to go direct to an industrial port, McKenzie, whereas the container business and some of the containers on flat car or just the straight container business would grow and continue to come into the port of Anchorage. And I think it's well within the bounds to deconflict those and to optimize those so that you get the advantage of both, actually. In terms of the advantage to the state, I think we've always felt that once you combine transportation and you combine power and you combine data transmission, if you get those threes together in a corridor, the entrepreneurs come out of the woodwork, and it really offers up an opportunity and probably some opportunities we've probably not even explored or talked about with anybody. But if you go back into the interior and look at timber or look at limestone or look at some other resource development opportunities that simply aren't feasible now because it's out of the question as far as transportation, that takes on a whole new look, and you not only get an advantage to the project in this one specific case for one customer, but from a transportation point of view, the railroad thinks for the future, this would probably be a great move for the state.
Okay, of course, we'll hear from the Port of Anchorage, but at least the conversations I've had with the Port of Anchorage is that they see their play in this as an interim to make it work for Agrium, being a good neighbor, if you will. But they would prefer at some point in time an alternative location. I think that's right, but they'll be able to speak for themselves. But do you get any different impression from that from Anchorage? Or
no, we don't. And again, we talk in these groups that talk about transportation at the 50,000-foot level, and the idea of coordinating transportation as a nexus point when you've got tidewater and you've got rail and you've got truck, you've got containers, you've got ships, and then you've got the business and the customers all in this very close region, it needs a lot of cooperation. And in fact, it almost begs at some point in the growth and development of all this for some sort of an authority that can sit there and play these so we're not all competing against one another in Washington for federal dollars or state dollars or whatever. And I would throw the bridge in there, too. If the bridge is going to be there, the bridge is going to be a big player at both ends of that. And so in some of the discussions we have at that 50,000-foot level, this is kind of the long look, 25-year look kind of thing that the railroad's doing.
Okay. And I might add, this is kind of phase one of a two-phase discussion today. We'll bring in the boroughs. Mr. Bopp is not online, but also the Kubota board to discuss that implication. And that's an excellent point that you make. Does Usabelli have something to add to us after we go to Anchorage? Donna Bolts. Hello, Donna.
Yes, sir.
Could you give us your professional perspective as a representative after you put your name on the record?
I would be glad to. I'm Donna Bolts, the Deputy Director for the Port of Anchorage.
Yeah, Donna, the question is, you know, since we have talked about the Port of Anchorage in its keenness, at least initially, and getting be part of the logistical network to get coal down to Agrium, could you just give us your perspective of that course of action?
Sure. I think that what already has happened, the Port of Anchorage is in the third year of a port intermodal expansion program. I think everyone knows that. We already have expanded the rail line onto Port of Anchorage property, and the current expansion project supports Agrium's construction timeline. In fact, last year we filled in an additional 21 acres at the Port of Anchorage, and this summer we will continue to work on the north end of the Port of Anchorage with the construction of barge berths, which will be completed in 2007-2008 construction season. We have worked very closely with Agrium to talk about how we would fit the business into the master plan and how we would work some contract issues with them as well. But we believe that the facility and the timing is very well postured to support Agrium for the Port of Anchorage.
Okay, very good. Are there any concerns that register that might be showstoppers or that we should be aware of from the port's perspective?
There are not. It will take very close coordination, but with the construction timeline that Agrium currently has laid out and everything that we have in our phasing program, Mr. Chairman, we can support this.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Donna? Okay. Thank you, Donna. Appreciate it very much. If you could please stand by in case we do have some additional questions, we would appreciate it. And at this point in time, Senator Green.
Yeah, maybe I could ask Donna. I was wondering about when in an urban setting and you have the exchange of product in that, I don't know how they do that, how you go from train to barge to whatever, but do you have a lot of
coal dust.
Coal, thank you. That is a big phrase. Coal dust that impacts the local subdivisions or people around there, and what happens in an urban setting if you've got one train every 18 or 20 hours coming in?
I don't know whether the railroad or the port's better to answer that. I'm not sure. Maybe Usabelli. Donna, we'll give you a shout at it in a moment. Huh? Go ahead.
When we're looking at the transportation portion during phase one, we put in the cost to assume that in a setting like Anchorage, it probably wouldn't apply.
Wait, let me stop you real quick. Sorry. Put yourself on record so we don't get in trouble with the.
Dan Graham, I'm a consultant working for Usabelli Coal Mine. When we were in the phase one portion of the study in a setting such as Anchorage, we included costs to have 100% covered and contained storage and dust collection right from train offloading through to a dome storage through to transfer to the ship, and actually dust collectors on the ship loading portion as well all the way through.
Thank you.
Oh, very good. Donna, you anything to add from the Port of Anchorage's perspective on environmental impacts of cross-loading, transloading coal?
Sir, we asked exactly the same question, and Dan Graham is the one who answered our question as well, and he answered it as he did today.
Okay, thank you. And Dan, what's the name of your organization?
Technical Field Services.
Yeah. You know you're now liable.
No.
No. No, thank you, Dan. That was just a joke. Could you, in a broader perspective, give us your professional thought on this course of action from source to transportation to getting to Agron to make it work?
The logistics tells you when you look at a map why Healy, why not Beluga, which is right across the inlet, which actually during phase one we looked at both sources, and they're very competitive. The advantage Healy has at this time is we have there's ample reserves in the area. It's a permitted operation. It's capitalized, and a key thing in Healy right now is I consider it a banker's mine. It's a Monday through Friday 9 to 5, whereas most mining operations are 24/7, and over half of this additional capacity can be picked up just by adding staff and running the equipment longer, and so that that gives the mine an advantage there to make the supply, and the fact that it's there, it's existing, and it's operating, and working with the railroad to try to get the transportation costs as well under control as we can makes the delivery from Healy something that you can rely on in this time period, the 2011 time period that they're shooting for. There's really nothing to stop it from being able to happen. I mean, physically everything's in place, and it can be delivered from the mine in Healy. Another big advantage we see to this is if you recall in 2003, the Alaska Energy Authority did their power study for the rail belt, and one of their key conclusions was that the rail belt was way too dependent on gas-fired power and needed to diversify their power base. And I think this project, along with the project MEA is bringing forward, gets about halfway to their recommendation of trying to diversify the power into the rail belt using coal. And the lowest cost coal states in the U.S. are states like Wyoming and Montana that have 90% of their power generated by coal, and their rates are substantially lower than any other state in the nation, and it would be a way for Alaska to keep their power costs down. So from both perspectives, I think it's a good project for meeting that need as well.
Question for Dan?
Yeah. Thank you. What percentage of the total rail belt energy does 70 megawatts make?
Total generation capacity, just numbers off the top of my, it's between 1,000 and 1,200 megawatts is what the total capacity in the rail belt is right now, and it's a small percentage of that is coal. So if we were able to add, if 70 megawatts were added in the Nikiski, and if Matanuska Electric succeeds in their 100 megawatts, you know, you've just added a little over 10% of coal to the mix there.
And just follow up. What is the average megawatt cost expected to be for using coal as opposed to using natural gas in the rail belt? Do you have any idea?
I would refer you. Matanuska Electric just released their. They did just the exact study on there, and it was. You know, I better not quote the numbers. I don't have them exact, but it's not quite half, but it's about 30 or 40% lower for coal than it is with natural gas.
Sorry, would you say that again one more time, please?
I believe the cost of power generation from coal was about 30% lower than what power costs from natural gas were in their investigation that MEA did just completed.
Yeah, we'll check with MEA to verify the numbers. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question along the similar lines, but if we broaden that scope out, Is there in the industry a roughly a break-even price of natural gas where coal becomes more efficient as far as electrical generation than natural gas? And not particularly in the rail belt, but just in the continental U.S.
The number a few years ago was the break-even was around $2 to $2.50 per million BTU. And I think the Cook Inlet gas is now approaching $6 per million BTU for that. So we've surpassed that break-even point in Cook Inlet.
Senator Wagner?
Just for comparison, how many megawatts does the Beluga generation plant put out?
I believe it's about 358 megawatts, somewhere in that neighborhood. They're good. They're
big. That for comparison to the size of the unit they were talking about, really. Yeah.
And that's a third of the rail belt is out of that one facility.
Dan, if you would, I see that you're listed as a former senior engineer for Usabelli. What your expertise in Lower 48 and what's going on there with coal activities? Good, low, bad, don't know anything? Where are you?
I won't claim any expertise on the Lower 48 coal markets.
Okay. But let's speak in general. When you look at Alaska, my assumption is we have a tremendous amount of coal. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is.
You just got to figure out how to make it work?
Yes.
You agree with that? Gasification, is that a technique that we should be in hot pursuit of? Or just if can't do anything else with it?
If it's solely for the purpose of generating power, gasification may not be your best option. In this case, where the gasification, you generate power and you're able to use the products of the gasification, then it makes sense in this particular situation.
Right. And in the Blue Sky project, if you look at on the scale of feasibility, is this feasible under optimum circumstances, or would it have to be fine-tuned to almost make it work from a coal miner's perspective or engineer?
Speaking of Blue Sky in itself, I may defer to Tim. When we went into the initial costing during phase one of the project, we didn't want to kill the project by having too many factors of safety built in. We didn't want to undercut ourselves and build optimization in early in the process. We tried to put it right down the middle of the best estimate that we could come up with of where we thought coal deliveries would be and the rest of the project, and maybe Tim can speak to how that fit together. But.
Yeah, Tim, go ahead. Okay.
I think, you know, every project is going to have its challenges and its opportunities, but one of the unique things about this project is so many good things come together in one place. You've got an existing facility that is there and will not have a feedstock source, and so that's a great anchor. You've got a demand for low-cost energy in South Central that's currently provided by generating electricity through expensive and declining source of natural gas. You got the ability to produce more oil for our fields through enhanced oil recovery, and you've got a chance to do that in an environmentally sensitive way. And so it's a lot of good things come together. We've still got challenges to prove out that feedstock economic viability. There's challenges of capital cost. But for a gasification project, this has certainly got to be one of the top projects around because so many things come together that are positive in one place.
Okay. Let's assume this works, and for those of us that have short memories, if you mentioned it, you mentioned in 2000, as I recall, we lost about 80 jobs.
2004.
Okay. Assuming this project's working, we're in 2012, thereabouts, plus or minus a bit, and we're up and operating. What's the plus-up of jobs that you're describing?
The plus side of jobs is that we'll retain the 250 jobs that are currently at the Agrium's Kenai Nitrogen operations. We'll create more jobs through the mine, the railroad, the transportation infrastructure. We'll retain all of the indirect jobs, which is in the neighborhood of 400 to 600. Plus, we'll have construction jobs in the neighborhood of 1,100 to 1,400 construction jobs during the construction period. So the overall impact on jobs, including directs and indirects, could be, I believe, in the neighborhood of 600 plus jobs impacted.
Okay. And if you will, we will check with Homer Electric, but if you were to characterize, in your opinion, Homer Electric's attitude towards this?
Homer Electric has signed on to be a partner in the lead in the power block development. They've been very active with us and eager to find a way to make this project work for them, for their cooperative. Ultimately, they're responsible for commercializing the power that is sold under the grid, and they'll be the ones that we work with to determine what that can be sold for and how much can be sold. But right now, they're a very active and an enthusiastic member of our team.
Okay. Other questions of... Yes, Senator Stevens.
Yeah, could we go back to the railroad?
Yes.
Question, Mr. Gamble. I appreciate the comment on the transportation issues, but one of the major issues that that you mentioned, Mr. Gamble, was bonding of the project. Could you give us a discussion on that doesn't go into so much detail that you lose the layman, but what are you going to actually be paying for, and what are you going to be funding, and what is the potential impact on the railroad? Is there any negative impact possible here?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Senator Stevens, for the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Alaska Railroad, and as Pat mentioned, we've been working with Agrium for a number of months on looking at a number of the questions that you actually asked, and trying to examine would there be an opportunity for the railroad to use its unique abilities to further assist with this project and therefore assist with the railroad. And without going into too much detail, just like to mention that when the railroad was transferred from federal ownership to state ownership, in the Congressional Transfer Act was a provision that we believe allows the railroad to issue tax-exempt bonds that would not be subject to the Internal Revenue Code. So this is a very powerful tool that actually sort of rolls you back in time to when the use of the old industrial development bonds were used for tax-exempt financings of items that were not normally thought of as for directly a governmental purpose. So working with our financial team, we have looked at this, and we believe that the language that we've been given and was reaffirmed in the 1986 Tax Reform Act could allow us to do this. We have not to this point tested that language and tested that these unique powers that we believe we've been given. So Agrium and the railroad could be an outstanding opportunity to gain clarity on this. But from our perspective, we think that the impact on the Alaska Railroad would be nothing but positive, in that we would get working, if we were able to move forward on this initiative and use tax-exempt debt, it would certainly, we believe, impact the project's economics in a positive way, and therefore, assuming obviously the railroad would be involved in the transportation piece of it, so therefore helping us out on that front also. All positives, no negatives that we've ascertained at this point.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Mr. Gamble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might add that the determination with regard to the IRS gets more and more solid the more and more the link between the railroad and the customer is. And so as we're working with Agrium right now, we're working to define that link and make it a no-brainer in the case of taking it forward to conduct this test with the IRS. We're very confident we can do that in this particular case. I mean, the situation is set up very nicely for that, and we're pretty confident that if we do that correctly, we're not going to have a problem with the IRS. I believe, Senator Stevens, you also asked, what are we going to bond for? There are really two components here that are that are possible. One of them is with partnering with Agrium on the larger project, and I would defer to them to talk about any of the specifics of that at the present time. And the second one is, as we talked about before, the Matsu Borough is very interested in getting that rail line extension down to Port McKenzie, and one option that we will consider in the whole process of looking at who's going to pay for what would be that the railroad look at using its tax-free bonding capability for that as well. And how you roll them in together or how you separate them so on and so forth, has not yet been determined, but it's clearly on the docket to examine, and we've got a number of people that are doing that as we speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
I guess a couple questions. Number one, what do you have any idea how much in bonds you would be seeking? To the extent that you're a public corporation, would that require legislative approval? And if there was hypothetically a default, to what extent would the state be liable for that for the amount?
Certainly. Senator Huggins, Senator Wilkowski, at the current time, we are looking at it right somewhere in the $2.5 to $2.6 billion range is the total amount of bonds that we'd be looking at. And through our enabling statute, we are required to have legislative authorization to issue public debt. So, yes, we would be coming to the legislature for that. And the, you know, one of the basic tenets of this initiative or this financing would certainly be that it would be non-recourse to the Alaska Railroad, certainly. And by statute, all debt issued by the Alaska Railroad is not an obligation of the state of Alaska.
Is not an obligation?
Is not an obligation.
So who, if there was a default, who would ultimately be responsible for this?
And we're looking through a number of different structures at this point, but the basic one that we all come back to is the project. That would be it, effectively Agrium or whatever structure they have set up would be basically on the hook for the repayment of the bonds.
If I might add, as I recall, we went through last year with $165 million, the same process, and that the statute clearly stated that the state was not on the hook for the money. Senator Stedman.
I must have misunderstood a little earlier, because I thought you said it was a virtual riskless bond, but no. If you issue $2.5 billion worth of bonds and it turns upside down, clearly, even though it's maybe a non-recourse bond, clearly it's going to impact the railroad in future debt obligations, I would think, or future expansion obligations.
Senator Stedman, certainly, even if you have, you know, all the legal documents in a row saying that it is non-recourse to the Alaska Railroad would certainly be, you know, a part of that financing, and it would not reflect well on the Alaska Railroad for something like that. But the actual obligation, the debt obligation, would not be to the Alaska Railroad. The main, you know, for lack of a better term, the balance sheet or the full faith and credit of the railroad would not be pledged for the repayment of that, of this debt, as we're talking about the current structures.
Well, I understand the technical aspect of the who ends up holding the bag, but you know, there is impact, you know, when you're looking at over $2 billion worth of potential bonds to be issued if it does turn upside down. I mean, the railroad's going to go on in time and have other expansion issues to be dealt with if we're dealing with the gas line or whatever we're dealing with over the next decade or two decades. So I wouldn't characterize it as riskless to the railroad.
Senator Stedman, if I might, I mean, there is a responsibility if we're going to issue a conduit issuance that we're going to be on board with that administratively to the end of the term. In that sense, we have a responsibility and would be the administrative piece of that issuance all the way to the end of the term. And as Bill suggested, if we were to, if there were to be a problem, I have no doubt that we'd be in court with, along with everybody else. And then the court would determine whether or not we were in fact guarded as we've discussed that we would be. And we feel very confident that we would not be held financially liable, as the law says. The other piece about the risk assessment, the risk analysis, I mean, it's just like any other business risk analysis. We would make a recommendation to our board. Our board would very carefully examine that risk analysis that we presented to them, and before it ever came here, it would have to pass muster with our board. And they are, in fact, very aware of where we are with this, and they're waiting in the wings for the point in time here when we take the next step. So they're going to be along with us all the way as well, and as part of that risk analysis. But your comments are correct in the sense that we're not untied from this entirely. We do have responsibilities.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you discuss the timeline with the IRS and how that works out? Is this going to be years in the processing, or is it something that would be answerable in the short term?
Senator Stevens, yes. We have to go forward with a private letter ruling request to the Internal Revenue, we believe, to make these bonds marketable. And by their statutes, the Internal Revenue is to issue a determination within 6 months of when the application is complete. And that's sort of a key phrase at the end, as they determine when the application is complete. So it can and often is a lengthy process that we would be embarking on. And that's part of the why, you know, you would need legislative approval. You need to make the project look very real to the IRS. They don't, for private letter rulings, they don't rule on hypotheticals or what ifs or anything like that.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to check and see if we got Bill pop on with the shit. Hey, Bill, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Yeah, have you listened to our conversation here in the last 20 to 30 minutes?
Yes, Senator, I have, and I appreciate the opportunity to listen in on this.
Yeah, would you put yourself on the record and just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of anything you would like to for us to appreciate from the borough's perspective, Kenai Borough perspective?
Well, obviously this project is very important to us, and we believe it needs to be given every opportunity to go forward and succeed, not only to benefit the Kenai Peninsula Borough, but to benefit the state of Alaska, to give opportunities for major new value-added manufacturing opportunities for a resource that previously has lain pretty much dormant other than for export in raw form. We see tremendous opportunities that will ripple through the economy, not only here in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, but through South Central Alaska and Rail Belt Alaska, through the number of opportunities for collateral development in power generation, in raising the level of expertise and technical experience within the Cook Inlet region. That carries over into other industries. When we have a major facility like this in place, it carries over into the support industry, which then raises their level of expertise and available services that can then be used for existing industries as well as to attract other industries that may need and require those same types of technical expertise. This is a very, very large project, and Agrium has taken on quite a task in trying to take this project forward. I would note that this type of technology is gaining quite a bit of traction elsewhere in the world, especially in the Pacific Rim. Communist China itself has booked and sanctioned almost $70 billion worth of these types of facilities, coal gasification and coal-to-liquids technology. This is a technology that is beginning to be embraced in quite a few regions around the planet, and Alaska has the opportunity to be at the forefront of that new technological development and to spin off any number of economic opportunities for the South Central region as well as the state.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Questions for Bill? Bill, Charlie Huggins here. Question for you on there was made mention of improvements of port facilities on the Kenai. Are you up to speed on what would be required, or any thoughts on that?
In our discussions with Agrium, and you know, obviously we don't know what their final plans are, but some of the opportunities that may present themselves is a improved dock structure and port facility in the Nikiski area, as well as the synergies that would take place at Point McKenzie facility. If that is, forgive me, I am in the conversation just a little bit late, but my understanding is that the Point McKenzie port in Matsu is being discussed as a transship point for the coal coming down from Keeley, and that obviously is another addition to the infrastructure base in Cook Inlet, which thereby helps us to attract more industrial opportunities throughout the region. You know, these dock facilities will be multi-purpose, is my understanding, and or potentially multi-purpose. And with that in mind, that just again leads to spinoffs that benefit the greater economy.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bill, for joining us. Lisa, you have anything to add? You thought you were going to get off the hook. You have anything to add? Okay.
I gave all my comments.
Nope. Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that has anything to add on the proposition? Yeah, just a couple, three words. I mean, the way I see this in conversation and talking to people, I would ask you to correct me if I'm in error. And Senator Wagner and I have talked about this on some occasions, and is that near midterm, Agrium is obviously a target to make sure that you're successful in the jobs and your export business. Hopefully it grows well beyond $163 million worth. But equally important, probably to a greater degree in the future, is us leveraging additional coal marketing, which, as I listen to people, whether it's around the country or around Alaska, that it's a deposit that we have here, has tremendous potential, but thus far we hadn't leveraged at all. We talk about selling, we talk about customers, but we don't use it and we don't sell much of it. And correct me if I'm wrong in that. That's a tremendous thing, because I think of it as the third leg in the energy stool within the state, either revenue or domestic use. On the other hand, as General Gamble has said, when you look at this thing from the 50,000-foot level, the potential for leveraging new infrastructure to the future is one that we can't turn our back on. We don't blindly issue bonds that might be concerned to people that are professionally up to speed on bonding implications or what have you. But if we can tie those three things together and some of the other players, then we're all a winner. And it's for the future of Alaska. You're the near-term beneficiary. We sell lots of coal. We use a lot of coal. And, oh, by the way, the railroad grows. And we all benefit from that. But help me out if I'm in error in that thought process, please. Okay. Final comments from Senator Wagner.
Just one comment probably should be added just for information purposes. One of you want to talk about the qualities of coal and the similarity of the qualities of coal between the Beluga coal and the Healy coal, and explain the value of the coal and the BTU values and low sulfur content.
I think the crux of an example is the fact that right now, as the Pac Rim company, which has leases in the Beluga field, needs to send test shipments of their coal to potential customers, they contract with Usabelli to sell Healy coal to them because they're so identical that the characteristics of one match the characteristic of the other. So they're an interchangeable product. Once you design for one, you can burn either.
Okay. Good. Senator Wagner, anything else?
No.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and we appreciate it. Lisa, thank you for helping us pull this together. And, you know, this is just kind of, in my estimation, a real first shot publicly on making this work. Obviously, it's to the future, a lot of money involved, particularly on the railroads part, but a lot of potential, and let's see if we can make it happen. We're adjourned.